Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to the Leader's Toolbox on Firehouse.com. I'm your host, Rich Gassaway, and we are in Bend, Oregon, at the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association Spring Conference. And I ran into Paula Sage, who is the now recently retired Assistant Chief of Operations from the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue Department. And Paul recently co-authored a book that has caught my attention and is gaining a lot of interest in the fire service called Crew Resource Management, Principles and Practice. Before we get into the discussion on crew resource management in the book, let me tell you a little bit about Paul. He spent 29 years with Tualatin Valley, and like I said, he just recently retired as the Assistant Chief of Operations. He is also an associate professor at the Oregon Health Sciences University Medical School, where he teaches paramedics and medical students crew resource management, and he also spent 7 years as a flight medic, so his experience is certainly well-rounded. Paul, welcome to the Leader's Toolbox.
Thank you, Rich. Good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. It's great to be here at this great venue at the Oregon Fire Chiefs Conference, and the topic that you spoke on yesterday was one that was very interesting to me. Unfortunately, it wasn't crew resource management. It was about the ISO and changes coming in the ISO, and I'm going to plug that early and tell Paul that we're going to have him back when they get some finalization to those challenges that were in the fire service that we're trying to get some changes made in ISO grading system. But the things you had to say yesterday was very fascinating to me and very interesting. And I know a lot of people in the fire service are going to be tuned in to want to see those changes. Well, the first question, Paul, is why crew resource management in the fire service? What is it? Why do we need it?
There's a lot of different ways to describe crew resource management, but probably the best that I've heard or come across, or the best way I can do it, is crew resource management is a method to obtain collective situational awareness in a team. Collective being, that everybody has a stake in it. So when you talk about collective situational awareness, it's a little different than a collection of people. You know, a collection of people could be a bunch of people working together on a scene, and they all have their own certifications and their own job. But they're not working together collectively to get the job done in the safest and most efficient way. So what crew resource management does is it makes every single member of the team responsible for the successful outcome of what the team's objective is. And it does that in a fairly unique way of really embracing an open communication model. So crew resource management is really about having an open communication model where you maximize the effectiveness of every member on the team. So you have this collective situational awareness. Mm-hmm. And why I believe that's crucially important in emergency medical services and in the fire service is that if you read the NIOSH reports and you read the after-action reports associated with deaths and injuries of firefighters, a tremendous amount of them are associated with a couple different things that crew resource management was designed to help. And that is they're associated with poor decision processes. People who really don't understand how their own minds work as much as how other people's minds work on the fire scene. I know, Rich, you're real familiar with that in some of the work that you've done in your doctorate. Also, the other piece that's really crucial about crew resource management is not just that they aren't sure how those things work. They believe, a lot of people believe that conflict is something to be avoided, when in reality, conflict's a normal part of our everyday teamwork. And there's some very, very positive attributes to conflict if it's managed correctly. So CRM is really made or designed to allow all team members to provide input in a respectful way, to manage conflict effectively, and to allow the team leader to make a decision moving forward where he's got everybody's input. If it's done effectively, it can be very quick and very smooth. Mm-hmm. Probably one of the things that people worry about with CRM is they think it's team decision making. it really isn't team decision making at all. We have a leader of a team for a reason. The leader is expected to be the one to make the decision. So it really doesn't have to do with the making of the decision as much as it does the information that goes into it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does make sense to me. Now, you told me before we started the podcast, and something that just flagged to me really to be a really interesting point was that crew resource management came out of aviation, and particularly an incident that occurred in Portland that you were a part of. So let's just wind the clock back in time and tell the listeners where crew resource management originated and a little bit about this incident that occurred that was the spawning of crew resource management in aviation.
Certainly. It's kind of interesting. First of all, this happened many moons before I even knew what CRM was or how it was going to affect my life in the future. But there were several different collective situational awareness types of programs before the incident we'll talk about occurred, predominantly in the military. None of them, though, were extraordinarily effective, nor were they being shared among even branches of the military. And it wasn't until, most of the research indicates that it wasn't until 1978, on December 28th, there was a United Airlines flight from Denver, Colorado to Portland. It was a perfectly clear evening, very cold. It was below freezing in the Portland metro area. And as the plane prepared to make its descent into Portland International Airport, it had a warning light that indicated that there was a gear problem, a main gear problem. So this was a DC-8 aircraft with four engines. It had three crew members in the cockpit and a very, very experienced pilot who was known to be a really good stick, but also was known to be someone who ran a very tight cockpit. And in this particular event, to make a long story short, the plane circled the Portland International or the Portland metropolitan area for quite a while until eventually the crew members started warning the pilot that they were getting low on fuel. But Rich, as someone who's interested in communications, when you look at this transcript, they really aren't overtly warning the pilot as much as they're doing what we all tend to do when we're worried about something, is they're throwing out big hints, of which the pilot isn't grabbing on to any of those hints because he's still focused on the landing gear problem. And it isn't until one of the engines flames out about 20 miles from the airport that everybody realizes that the primary problem is not the landing gear, but it's their fuel situation. Mm-hmm. The plane is starved of fuel, and the pilot, being an excellent pilot as he is, simply aimed for a dark spot in metropolitan Portland and crashed the plane near 157th and East Burnside, which is a very densely populated area. Most of the people on board survived because there was no post-crash fire. But after that, the NTSB and the FAA started a program, because what came out of it was that this was a clear case of really big problems in cockpit communications. So what came out of it was a class or a program called Cockpit Resource Management. So the original CRM, a lot of it was cockpit. And then after going for several years with this program, they realized there was a lot more to the crew than the cockpit. There's the flight attendants, there's the ground maintenance people, there's people who load baggage. Every single one of them, if you're looking for collective situational awareness, had some input to give. So that was the origin of it. And I was on the accident. I was working as a paramedic on a commercial ambulance company in Portland at the time and responded as one of the initial responders to the plane crash. But so that's just kind of an interesting crossing of paths.
Yeah, you had no idea at the time that that incident would be the spawning ground for CRM, and here you would be then writing a book about CRM. Fortunately, there are many things the fire service can learn from the accidents of aviation. That's a class unto itself that I've taken on and done, and CRM certainly is one of those. Now, you said that CRM isn't team decision making. So, describe how the players of a company or at an incident how they interact. How do they give the kind of feedback to command in a way that creates this CRM environment, but is not quite team decision making.
Okay, well, first, it's you know, there's really a loop, and we describe in the book what that loop looks like, and it's been described in other ways. You know, we call it the critical communication loop. But essentially, it starts by being observational, meaning that if everybody's trained in CRM, then every member of the crew starts observing very closely for what's known as the inquiry phase, which is the very kind of beginning phase when people are wondering what's going on. And the inquiry phase is, if you're my leader, Rich, and I'm your firefighter, is there's really several ways for you to communicate with me, and really kind of falls into four basic categories in the fire ground. You either give me an order, take the inch and three quarter line in, you make a statement, just a random statement of some sort, you know, wow, that's a really big fire. You ask me a question, are you familiar with this, or is this the first time you've done it? Or interestingly, you behave in a certain way. You say nothing at all, you're just behaving in a certain way. So if I'm a member of your team, that's the initiation point, is anytime any team member says something. So what's really kind of interesting is this is an ongoing dynamic thing, is that you're observing your team members for what they say and what they do. The second step is called the advocacy step. And the advocacy step is probably the most crucial point, because the advocacy step is where we want the team member to speak up if what they're hearing their leader or their team member say, or what they're seeing their team member do, is incongruent with what they believe should occur on scene or what they're seeing. So if there's this incongruence and uncomfortableness, we want them to speak up. When we teach crew resource management, we focus a lot on team leaders on this critical point, because what happens is a lot of times people who are subordinate in rank or in expertise will actually throw out, we call it sense making, they'll throw hints out, expecting the leader to grab a hold of that hint. So one of the most crucial pieces of crew resource management is that you have to be specific and respectful in communicating your concerns. You can't just randomly say something and expect somebody to understand it. As you've mentioned in some of your classes in communications, specificity is very important, so is repeating it back. Mm-hmm. So the advocacy phase really would teach people has there's two ways to say, yes, Rich, I agree with what you told me, or I agree with your behavior statement, and there's only one way to say no. So what we teach people is the one way to say no is, hey, Rich, I understand you want to take an inch three quarter line in through the front door, but I'm concerned about that sag in the roof right there. What do you think if we do a defensive attack first and see what happens? You know, you basically are going to kind of engage you in conversation. Mm-hmm. And this is when you get to say conflict resolution, which is the next step. Hey, thanks for the heads up. I'm not worried about it. We're going in, taking a right, or, you know, whatever it is you say. And you make the decision to do it. The next step is then we observe it and critique it. But the two ways to say yes are, you could give me an order and I can say, I can repeat it back to you, take the inch and three quarters through the front door, or I can say nothing. So probably one of the most powerful lessons in crew resource management is, if you're a team member and your leader or your team member says or does something that you don't agree with, if you say nothing, you've said yes. That's just a key piece. Because what you don't get at the end of the crew resource management loop and something goes wrong is, if you've been taught CRM and you've been taught to speak up and you're being given an open environment to do so, you don't get a pass at the end and get to say, I knew that was going to happen, because you had a responsibility to speak up mm-hmm. and derail what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. So probably one of the most powerful moments for the firefighters and stuff learning CRM is that understanding, that light bulb that goes on that, oh yeah, saying nothing is saying yes. And it doesn't matter where I've taught across the United States, and I love teaching crew resource management, no matter where you teach it, you just see that, oh yeah, when I say nothing, I've said I agree. Mm-hmm. And most of the time people don't speak up. It's for the normal reasons associated with rank, egos, you know, all those other things that block us in the fire service mm-hmm. from doing the right thing.
Well, how in your book or in your classes, do you give any advice to a firefighter about how to speak up? Because, you know, as you were talking, I made a note to ask you, what's a firefighter do when they're afraid to speak up because, you know, they're outranked, or because they know that the person in charge isn't going to really appreciate their input? So what's the process by which you get the boss get the boss's attention, because I know this was really part of the problem in aviation, is that, you know, a lot of these captains had big egos and they really weren't interested in hearing what their crews had to say. In fact, I'm sure you're aware that, you know, when CRM first came out, they called it charm school, you know, to try to make the captains nicer, you know, because they were, you know, they were concerned about their big egos. Well, in the fire service, you know, I think there's a few big egos out there, too. So how does a line person, you know, gently get the attention of the boss and say, I think you're missing something here that could cause a problem?
Well, that's a very good point. And there's the unfortunate side of this is that crew resource management, in order for it to take, it takes a cultural change. It takes a top-to-bottom understanding of what it is you're trying to get. So really, when I go into organizations and teach crew resource management, you really sort of have one of three situations, Rich. You either have the line people who've heard about it and desperately want it, and you have leaders who are uninterested, in which case I tell them you've got 6 to 8 years before it will take, because the line people will take it, it resonates, and then eventually the top people above them are going to be gone. And when those line people become those people, they'll understand how important it was. You've got that's the slowest track. You have a little faster track where the leaders embrace it, and then you have to convince the line that it's okay to speak up. But the line has been beaten down by bad stories and other things over such a period of time that it takes a while to build the trust. The first time you speak up, you're not going to get slammed.
Yeah.
That'll take a couple of years, but not quite as long as the first one. The most effective way is when you have the leaders and the firefighters embracing this and willing to try it. And you also have to have, as we mentioned in the book, you've got to have time to give to allow people to make mistakes. Because every once in a while, you know, someone's going to bite back when they're under stress or something else. I mean, you know, if I'm your firefighter and I tell you something, you know, there's those times where you're under stress. There's 32 things going on. I mean, I taught a class once where one of the police officers said, there's 1,000 things going on. I'm aware of about 20, and I can do something about 5. You know, that's
yeah,
about right.
Yeah, right, right, yeah.
And so, you know, when you think about that in the company officer context, it's not unusual for me to be as respectful as I can and give you feedback and have you, you know, just snap back, you know, hey, we're just doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And in which case, you have to allow those kinds of things to happen. You got to allow people to have bad days. You got to allow it come full circle. And so it's a cultural change, and it takes time.
Yeah, good. Well, we're gonna take a break. This is the Leader's Toolbox on Firehouse.com. I'm your host, Rich Gassway. I'm with Paula Sage, who is the co-author of Crew Resource Management, Principles and Practice. We'll be back in just a moment.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Leader's Toolbox. I'm your host, Rich Gassway. We're in Bend, Oregon at the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association Conference, and I'm with a fellow presenter and author of Crew Resource Management, Principles and Practice, Paula Sage. And we are talking about this challenge or opportunity of crew resource management. Paul, what does it take to get CRM to take hold in an organization? You know, before the break, you said, you know, management or, you know, the command staff can be for it and the firefighters against it, or firefighters for it and the command staff against it. In the ideal world, everybody would be for it. Well, we don't always have that ideal world. So how do we get the CRM to take hold?
That's a good question, Rich. When I first went out to teach CRM, when I became an instructor, when I was a flight medic, so I thought, wow, this is great stuff. And I'd go teach primarily at the time to flight programs because fire departments weren't as interested in it. And I would follow up 9 months to a year later. When you leave, everybody's excited. Wow, this is a great concept. And I'd follow up 9 months later. And when I asked the managers, how's it going? The answer was always, oh, it's going great. So then I'd ask the flight line. And it was, well, we're not doing it. So I decided to do some research. And as part of the book, you know, it was like, hey, let's look into some research as to why this isn't taking hold. And what's really interesting is it falls down to kind of two primary factors as to why it doesn't take hold in different departments, whether they be flight programs, EMS, or whatever. The first, and so we address this comprehensively in the book. So one thing, I'm going to just switch to the book for a minute. Most of the other stuff I'd read on crew resource management in the past that Jeff Dyer and Bruce and I had looked at addressed what it was, and they mentioned a little bit on how to implement CRM, but it didn't tell you culturally what you had to do in the department. So I said, you know what, I'm going to write a book that talks about culturally what are the challenges. So the two biggest challenges, the first one is the power of story. So we have a whole chapter on the power of story. And really what that means is that in this business, we trade accuracy for speed. It's the way we operate. Not that we should all the time, but we do. And we use that intuitive decision-making skill where we're trading accuracy for speed. We make decisions that don't come out so well sometimes because we are going fast. But every single one of those incidents is analyzed in an analytic context. So people have a lot of time. Not only do they have time, they know that there was a bad outcome. So it tends in the fire service to generate stories around certain people's behavior. Well, you wouldn't believe what Paul or Rich did at that fire. And in reality, those stories are incredibly unfair because they don't take into consideration the pressures in the real world context. Mm-hmm. So because it generated stories, people were very reluctant to speak up. So the book is chock full of stories. We lead every chapter with a story. We lead one of the stories when I was teaching, I talks about a flight medic who learned crew resource management and spoke up as they were flying into weather and said, hey, I don't want to do this. And, long story short, they turned around, frustrated the pilot and nurse a great deal that they turned around. And a week later, they were getting ready to launch on a mission and the pilot's checking the weather. And as the paramedic walks into the room, he turns to the paramedic. The pilot does and says, well, let's ask so-and-so. He's the weatherman.
Uh-huh.
And, so as soon as that kind of stuff happens, so what happened was a story got generated about this paramedic turning the flight around, doing exactly what he was supposed to do. Well, it happens in the fire service all the time. So what I talk about is that there's a leadership responsibility to tamp down bad story or tell people, what's your story? Everybody's got that bubble falling around above their head, right, that mm-hmm. has the organizational stories mm-hmm. in it. The second piece that's really important for it to take hold, and I know you're familiar with this concept because I saw you using some of James Reason's stuff this morning, is the concept of a just culture. Now, a just culture treats errors and mistakes as learning opportunities, and it takes behavior that's bad on purposeful bad behavior and treats it differently. Unfortunately, a tremendous number of places treat errors and mistakes, what they do is they terminate the person, mm-hmm. and then they think they've solved the problem. And all they've done is leave a gaping hole for someone else to fall through. So it turns out that those departments that are able to, and this is mirrored in the airline industry, those departments that are able to have near miss reporting, that do great quality improvement, that treat errors and mistakes as opportunities to learn, and that tamp down bad stories are the most successful in implementing CRM. And they're very effective fire departments that can do this. You can get it done. Mm-hmm. But that's what it really takes, and that's the barriers to making it take hold.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned just culture. I put a plug in there. Captain Sullenberg, who landed the U.S. Airways flight on the Hudson, mm-hmm. was reading a book called Just Culture when the plane crashed. And I read an interview where he said that they were able to recover the plane and get him back his briefcase and his belongings. And the one thing that was in there that he wanted was his book, Just Culture by James Reason. So if you're looking for a read that talks about this culture of not being punitive, but learning from mistakes, that book is a good read.
There's another great Just Culture book too, Rich, by Sidney Decker, D-E-K-K-E-R.
Oh, you know what? It is Decker's book.
Yeah.
I did say James Reason. It actually is Sidney Decker's book, and yeah. I apologize to Sidney Decker for that. You're right. Yeah. I had James Reason on my mind, but it is Decker's book. Okay, how is CRM tied to high reliability organizations? I know you talk about that in the book, so let's tee that up a little bit.
Well, the concept of a high reliability organization, or an HRO, is becoming more prevalent in the fire service. But first, what is an HRO? And again, to distill it down to a nutshell, I'm sure people could have much larger explanations. An HRO, high reliability organizations, is associated with sort of any entity, any business, where a mistake or an error will lead to serious injury or death. So, your average grocery store clerk is not working for an HRO because while a mistake could be egregious in a cost piece, it's not going to kill someone generally. fire service, police work, the military, they're all HROs. So anytime we make an error, and that error can lead to death or serious injury, you have an industry where you have to be extremely highly reliable. So if you look at the HRO, a lot of work was done by James Wick, W-E-I-C-K. He's written some great books on HROs. If you look at the context of an HRO, it has a lot of the exact same things you need to change your culture in order to implement crew resource management. It has a focus on mindfulness, which is basically how situationally aware are your people, not individually, but as a team. So it starts off, an HRO is, it's all about being mindful. A significant portion of being an HRO, one of the major components is you have to have the ability to doubt, inquire, and update. So can you respectfully doubt what people say and what's going on without fear of repercussion? Can you ask questions without fear of repercussion? Are you getting updated as to what's going on all the time so that your situation awareness is maintained? That's a key component. Another key component of an HRO is a reluctance to simplify explanations. So a simple explanation is, you screwed up, it's your fault, you're fired. Or it's your fault, now there's a story that's created around the fact that you screwed up and it's your fault. More complex, and we get into this in the book, is to show how HROs will break down mistakes kind of into like four categories. What were the system errors, the policies and procedures that need to be fixed? What education and training was lacking to allow that person to do their job really well? What were the circumstances beyond your control as an operator? And lastly, what were the human factors? You know, were you fatigued? Did you have equipment that wasn't working for you or wasn't designed for the job? And what you'll find out if you really do an analysis, if you're an HRO, which is a learning organization, you'll learn a whole lot about the errors and mistakes because you didn't simplify the explanation. You took the time to look into why that error was made. That just totally enriches the culture of an organization, particularly a fire department. And it makes people want to open up and give feedback. Mm-hmm. So there's several other components to an HRO, but those are probably the most critical ones. And because if you are aiming to be an HRO and you follow those, you'll do a great job in implementing CRM.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Where do you think the fire services in general, are we ready to embrace what it takes to be HROs? Or do we have some work to do?
I think we have some work to do. I think that what's really exciting is watching some of the up-and-comers and some of the people who have started to embrace this 5, 6, 7 years ago are now becoming positions of leadership. Some of the IAFC and some of the other leadership that's in there now, they're really demonstrating that they embrace this sort of thing. Most exciting in some ways is if you look at some of the largest firefighting entities in the nation, such as the Forest Service and you know, those folks are actually putting out reports now, after action reports, that follow the HRO concepts. So where their reports used to lay blame, the most recent one on a fire in Washington State, instead of laying blame, used this differentiation of cause. You know, what are the causal factors that led to the person to make this decision? So it wasn't this person is a bad person, he made this decision. It was, what was his education and training? What rules was he working under? What was the culture? You know, what were all the things that went into him making this decision? So you as a chief can look at that and go, oh my God, we've got a whole bunch of that in my own department. Mm-hmm. But I think the fire service is moving that way. Unfortunately, unlike the airline industry, we don't have one single collective entity to tell us to do what they mm-hmm. did for crew resource management. So it'll probably take a while for us to get there.
Yeah, one of the things that, as you described, that I remember that I read that Sidney Decker wrote, I don't know if it was in Just Culture, I've read a few books by him, is that we tend to focus on what they call the sharp end of the decision. In other words, the end where, you know, the actual decision was made that somebody got hurt, you know, a nurse mm-hmm. gave a wrong medication, or a fire ground commander made a bad decision that resulted in a firefighter hurt. And we look at that and we say, that's where the problem lies. And many times, as he says, and what I hear you saying, is the problem doesn't, I mean, that's where you see the problem, because that's where the outcome occurred, but the problem, it was actually manifested itself along the way in policies and procedures and how that person was trained or retrained and how the organization communicates that the cause to these incidents, whether they result in casualty or near misses, are a lot deeper than just what's happening when the boots are on the street.
Absolutely. And what's really fascinating about this is, as you and I, as you know, as we go through our own careers and you start seeing how, you know, I mean, I personally, so you see how I behaved as a firefighter, paramedic, and as a rescue guy and as a company officer, you know, on through the career, you realize all these decision points where you could have done stuff better, you wish you'd had some of these tools. So there's a couple books out there that, besides this, the Crew Resource Management, some other ones, and Just Culture, there's a I like to try and teach my company officers that they need to think about how they think. A lot of us don't even do that. Mm-hmm. But it's really about checking that ego. And there's a really interesting book that has nothing to do with the fire service that's called Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. And it's a fascinating look. It's a very short book, an easy read, but it's a fascinating look into why do we become defensive when people point out mistakes to us? And it's a natural tendency because we don't want to look bad. We think that if somebody challenges our authority or challenges our statement or our order, like you would see in crew resource management, that that's an affront to us and our experience and our rank and everything else, right? Mm-hmm. When it turns out that you and I both have way more respect for those leaders who've actually admitted to their mistakes or asked us for input and considered it strongly, right? That's our best leader, mm-hmm. not the one who is the know-it-all, because mm-hmm. we all know the know-it-all doesn't.
Right.
So
they think they do.
They think they do, that's right. So I tell them, read this book, Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, because it's just one of those books that it makes you think about the way you think.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so there's little stuff like that that's powerful and helpful when you're going through this kind of class.
Well, outstanding. This has been a great, great podcast. I'm sure the listeners are going to benefit a lot by this. I encourage you, if you haven't bought the book yet for yourself or for your department library, it's Crew Resource Management Principles and Practice by Paula Sage, Jeff Dyer, and Bruce Evans. It's Developing a Culture for Open Communication. It's been recently released. I just came along at the first time. I was at a conference earlier this year, and they had it there as the new release from Jones and Bartlett. And I picked it up and I looked through it, and I told the lady, I said, I'll be back to buy it. And I went to lunch, and I come back, and she'd sold it. She only had one copy there on display, and she sold it to somebody, and I was so angry at her for doing that.
We'll have to fix that.
Yeah, so for the Jones and Bartlett person who was serving in I won't say where you were. I don't want to get anybody in trouble that works for the company, but I'm fixed that now because Paul has given me a complimentary copy, signed complimentary copy, and I certainly appreciate that. In closing, do you have any summary thoughts that you want to share with the listeners about the book or about the classes that you teach on CRM?
Just we like to have a lot of fun. So I'm interested in it, just as you are, in people's feedback on the book. This is more, it was written more of a textbook. So at the end of every chapter, there are exercises that you can do. There is an entire teacher companion piece that you can get along with it. But actually going out and teaching this, we just have a really good time. We, not unlike what you do, Rich, we use some real good interactive stuff to demonstrate to people how they think as a teams, and it's fun.
Good, good. So. All right, well, this is the Leader's Toolbox on firehouse.com. Again, we're at the Oregon Fire Chiefs Conference in Bend, Oregon, and I'd like to thank my guest, Paula Sage. And if you have any questions, we're going to put a link to how to reach Paul, either his website or his email, at the bottom of the player page, so you can reach out to him. Or if you're interested in having a program on crew resource management, that'll give you your contact to be able to get connected with Paul. So, Paul, thanks for being my guest. And
thank
until
you,
next time, we'll keep listening to the Leader's Toolbox. Send your questions into podcast@firehouse.com. That's podcast@firehouse.com. Goodbye.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.